Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Was Beethoven terrifying? To a musician, maybe. Or so composer Rob Capello tells us. He is back in town this week with his series, What Makes It Great, as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. This time, Capello is breaking down Beethoven's first and last quartets.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in what goes on under the hood, you know, unraveling the mystery. You know, I remember when I was in third grade and teachers would say, we're now going to do this classic piece. And I was going to say, but what makes it so great? How come it's classic? Just because you told me wasn't enough.
Rob Capello joined us in Studio 3 to take us under the hood of Beethoven's evolving genius, including what made his music so groundbreaking and so challenging. He started by situating Beethoven with some well-known artists of the 20th century.
Picasso, Beethoven, and the Beatles. People who started in one place but become something completely different. And I'm fascinated by people who continually reinvent themselves. And no one reinvented themselves or transformed themselves more than Beethoven. And not only is Beethoven's career about transformation, that's really what makes his music special. You know, I often say that in Beethoven, what it's really about is becoming and not being. In other words, what matters in Beethoven is not what a musical idea sounds like when you first hear it. This is not that interesting. What matters is what an idea can become over time, because in a way it's a metaphor for all of us. What we want is the possibility of transformation. We want to start off as the ordinary people Beethoven starts off with and become this magnificent version he finishes with. So transformation is what interests me in Beethoven, both in his music and in his career.
So you're going to illustrate that for us. Usually when you come on, you play the songs yourself, but you've chosen music for a quartet. Pretty hard to play four different parts with two hands on one instrument. So we're going to use audio clips instead. Tell us about this first clip we're going to hear.
Yeah, the whole idea was, how could I get across this transformation in a single evening? And so I thought I would pick the first and last string quartets because they literally span his entire career. The first one, Opus 18, number 1, published in 1800, is who he was when he was bursting on scene in Vienna, explosive, alive, making his name. And the last one we're going to look at is actually the last complete piece he finished his entire life. So taking these two similar pieces, a quartet and a quartet, two similar movements, in this case, a scherzo movement and a scherzo movement, gets us to see the transformation he underwent at the beginning of his career. We're going to use only one phrase.
Okay, tell me the name of the quartet that this first phrase comes
the
from again.
The first phrase is Opus 18, number 1, his first published string quartet, and here's one phrase from the scherzo. Listen quickly. It only goes by in about 20 seconds.
Okay.
That's it. Now, for Beethoven, that's an idea. In and of itself, you're not going to write home and say, my God, I just heard the most amazing thing ever. That is just the beginning idea. But how does he put it together? The basic idea couldn't be simpler. It's what I'm going to call, it's important you learn these technical terms.
Very technical.
I'm going to call it choppy. That's an idea for Beethoven.
Okay.
Just a long note and two short ones. Long.
Okay.
Choppy, that's it. Now, he always assumes you're really smart, so you only need to hear an idea twice. So the first one is choppy. Then you do choppy higher. Now, what would be horrible and boring to do next? A third choppy
one
would be intolerable. It would insult your intelligence. But I'll show you
what
it would have sounded
offended.
Like. Here's the first one. Second. This would be intolerable.
Stop, it's intolerable.
Stop. So what Beethoven does is he gives you the first two, and then he changes them. So the first one goes like this. Once. Second. But then. So I loved your raised eyebrows. That's what we wanted.
I see what he did there.
So we'll call this smooth. So now we've got choppy, choppy, smooth. Let's get that in our ear one more time. Choppy, choppy, smooth. Okay, now we've done choppy and we did it choppy. We did a smooth. What would be logical to do to get smooth in your ear? A second smooth. Here's what that would have sounded like. Here's choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth. Choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth. But no such luck. Beethoven is more alive than that. Here's what actually happens. Expect choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth.
I will.
We get choppy, choppy, smooth, but then
Truly.
Now, if you're inside, that trill is like the coolest thing you ever heard because it's not smooth.
And or choppy, really. It's like this other thing.
And suddenly it's like a new character in the play. We've got a trill. And now does the trill go up or down? Up. Trill up. But then what do we answer it with? Trill down.
Oh, my.
That's a musical sentence. Now, is loud a surprise? Yes, because everything else has been soft. Is down a surprise? Yes, because we just went up. Now, the entire movement is based on nothing but that. Transformations of choppy, choppy, smooth, trill up, trill down.
Okay.
In the program, you're going to, by the way, have to memorize that.
Well, I'm impressed. This is early, though, and you keep saying, you know, these ideas, nothing particularly brilliant. That sounds kind of brilliant for early in his career.
Even early is brilliant for Beethoven. But over the course of the piece, the whole game is we're going to always start with choppy, choppy, and what comes next is constantly changed. It's all about transformation, always upending your expectations, like the best mystery novel or the best detective show. That's what early Beethoven is all about.
Okay, so your next sound, though, the next cut that you brought us is actually from later Beethoven.
This is now 27 years later. This is the last complete piece he ever wrote. This is from the middle of a scherzo movement, the same movement, and it starts off with, again, a very simple idea, just a scale that's divided between instruments. Here's the scale by itself. That doesn't sound so difficult. It's a scale. Here's what it sounds like in the group.
That is not a scale.
It is a scale. Now, but there's something else going on as well, and that's what it's all about. So you got a cello doing the scale. Then it passes to the first violin. But you've got an accompaniment going like this. Now, it changes on the seventh bar. I'll count for you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's going to be the whole game. When do we change the scale? If I put it together, you can hear it changing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now, the whole game is about repeating that scale over and over again, but changing it a different place. The next time it comes in, it changes on the fifth bar. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we're done.
Yep.
Every time it comes back, it's either in a different key, but it's the same tune, but we change in a different place. But then we get the transformation that Beethoven is all about. In the middle of the movement, it comes back one more time. You hear the scale one more time, and then all of a sudden, the universe you know dissolves. You are plunged into the abyss, a passage unprecedented for which no composer had ever given us a hint that this could even be music, a passage of such utter fury and terrifying apocalyptic fury for which you are utterly and terrifyingly unprepared. Here we go. And now back to where we started.
That sounds exhausting. It's overwhelming.
I mean, you have no idea how exhausting it actually is to play.
I can't imagine.
I mean, now, here's the thing about it, though. That little thing that repeated over and over again. You remember our little cello scale started like this. Now, I often say composition is about listening for possibility, hearing possibilities in the ordinary that no one else would have missed. Now, this doesn't sound so spectacular by itself. That's it. He takes just these notes, changes one note and turns it into this, and then plays that 47 times.
47 times.
The whole accompaniment to that apocalyptic passage as the cello and the viola and the second violin over and over fortissimo playing 47 times until Philip Glass and the Minimalists arrived. No one had ever repeated with such fury the same thing over and over again. While they're doing this one little figure 47 times, we're playing this ridiculous melody that's unplayable in the violin. It's barely doable. You know, for Beethoven, when things are really hard to play, it's because he's trying to say something that we couldn't say in normal speech. It's not difficult for the sake of difficulty. It's difficulty because we're trying to communicate something that the instrument itself cannot get across. This melody melody is ridiculously high.
And that's something the violin plays?
The first violin has to play that above the apocalypse going on underneath.
And do first violinists say this is nearly impossible?
It's impossible to play? You know, sometimes I ask them to demonstrate it by themselves, and they look at me like I'm the worst person on the planet. It's bad enough to play it with the other people underneath. When you try to play it by yourself, you're leaping around on the instrument. It is literally virtually unplayable. But Beethoven always said, I don't care about your fiddle. This is what I'm trying to get across. No one had ever let ugliness or this extreme world of emotions into a single piece of music.
Okay, but that wasn't ugly.
Well, it's not ugly, but it's extreme. Put it this way. Beethoven was more extreme than any previous composer. He was like your worst nightmare of a dinner guest. I mean, whenever he would come
in, sounds kind of gangster.
People would ask him to improvise, and he would play these exquisite passages. And just when they were dreaming, like White Christmas or something like that, he would bang down the keys as loud as he could and then laugh and walk out. That's the kind of guy he was. The kinds of emotions that his music contained were different than what anyone else had ever written. In a way, it's a revolution socially. It's saying, no longer am I your servant. No longer am I going to give you the polite world of polite classical music. Now it's going to be my inner voice communicating to you, you support me. I am the center of creativity. What my voice is what matters. I run the show. You know, my favorite quote from Beethoven is he says, there will always be 1,000 princes. There is only one Beethoven.
What do you enjoy most about doing this type of performance for audiences?
What I enjoy is watching the light bulbs go off and watching people actually hear things for the first time, because then in a way it's a connection. One of the reasons I did this was oftentimes performance can feel like a monologue rather than a dialogue. And so it's that magical moment when what we're hearing on stage is the same moment that you're actually hearing and getting it. You're speaking the same language that we're speaking. Then we are no longer a me. We're part of a we. The other reason I did this was I was a Yale professor in my 20s. It was my very first job. And it was very fun to be at 24 years old conducting the symphony orchestra.
You're kind of fancy then.
It was very fancy. But then I got an offer to conduct on Broadway, the Tony Award-winning musical. And for 3 months, I tried to do both jobs at the same time. I would teach Beethoven symphonies during the day, take the train to Broadway, conduct the Tony Award-winning musical every night, and then take the train back. And that was where this really started to hit me, because whatever you think about that Broadway music, people get it. They speak the language of those Broadway shows. Not only were they willing to pay extraordinary amounts of money to come, but people got it. Then I would take the train back and do these Beethoven symphonies, and the number of people who got it the same way, who really spoke the language of that music, was infinitesimally small. And I just thought, I don't want to do it if they're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful quote from Walt Whitman. He said, to have great poets, there must be great audiences. To me, to have great music, there must
great audiences.
To me, to have great music, there must be great listeners. Yeah. And that's really what the series is about, is creating a world of great listeners.
Right.
And that moment when they're hearing it and you're playing it and we're in the same room really speaking the same language, that music becomes as alive as if it were written today.
Composer Rob Capello will be performing with the Verona Quartet Sunday at the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall at 3 p.m., That concert is presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and you can find more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. And Rob's book is called Listening for America, Inside the Great American Songbook, from Gershwin to Sondheim.